I'm Scott Paul, and this is the Manufacturing Report.
If we do not learn a lesson as a result of COVID-19, then we're at fault for that as a country and as a collective. This exposed fragility in our supply chain. But I will warn everybody that the fragility will exist if we don't help the supply chain grow in the United States. And we need some strong signals to make that happen.
When the COVID-19 pandemic first hit the United States, the U.S. textile industry was uniquely positioned to answer the urgent call for PPE and quickly shifted production to serve America's frontline workers. Since then, the need for PPE hasn't abated, and the critical importance of safeguarding America's domestic manufacturing capacity is more vital than ever. Today, Kim Glass, the president and CEO of the National Council of Textile Organizations, shares how the U.S. government can push back against China's mission to solidify its dominance of the global PPE market by investing in American-made PPE. My conversation with Kim, next on the Manufacturing Report. Hey, Kim, thanks for joining the podcast today.
Thanks for having me.
So, Kim, why don't you tell our listeners a bit about the National Council of Textile Organizations, who you represent, and what your mission is?
So we're a trade advocacy organization based in Washington, D.C., and we represent the domestic textile industry. We're seen as the voice of the domestic textile industry in Washington. We represent fiber, yarn, fabric, and finished apparel manufacturers throughout the country. And we have about 150 members, and our industry employs approximately 600,000 workers.
And obviously, Kim, prior to the pandemic, and I know from my own work, the garment and textile industries had faced just a barrage of imports and other sorts of challenges, even before we headed into the pandemic. But could you perhaps let folks know what some of the major concerns and opportunities were for textile and related supply chains in our economy before the pandemic even began?
So before the pandemic began, you've seen a lot of offshoring of our industry over the last few decades, particularly to countries like China and other low-cost producers to Asia. Regrettably, in the early 1990s, the industry made a lot of finished apparel here in the United States, but that dissipated with the accession of China to the World Trade Organization. And since the finished apparel did go primarily offshore, our industry built co-production supply chains with our Western Hemisphere trade partners, which has been a key destination for U.S. textile exports. Our industry, hit by the Great Recession, our industry was starting to recover over the last few years. In fact, we are now the second largest textile exporter in the world. And you've seen about $20 billion of investment from this industry over the last decade. So in the areas of fiber, yarn, and fabric, you're seeing highly automated technical products. This is not your mother's textile industry anymore. We are making some of the most innovative products in the world, and that's how we've been able to compete globally, is to ensure that our products are meeting higher standards. And that has given us a differentiation in the industry.
Something that some of the other, I guess, low-wage, low-cost, less advanced mills and supply hubs around the world aren't able to match right now. So obviously, 2020 has brought a different set of challenges to the industry, but also some opportunities to help. And so for your members, what was it like when the pandemic hit and you realized it wouldn't be business as usual anymore?
So for our industry, when the pandemic hit in the early spring, orders immediately started dropping off. For our industry, 90% of their business vanished. When you don't have consumer spending, people aren't shopping, automobile companies are not buying the interior parts necessary that use textile components. It had a tremendous ripple effect across the industry. I saw idle mills across the Carolinas and states like Ohio that weren't operating whatsoever. Some of these operations were idle because of what was happening with COVID, and others because of lack of sales. And so here you had this industry in our own backyard that was well positioned to say, how can I help in this crisis? What resources do I have to help constitute supply chains overnight to getting people the masks and the gowns and the other personal protective equipment they need? And so it really was an opportunity for our industry, not just to gain some business, but to actually heed the call of our nation and what our healthcare workers needed, to retooling operations overnight and trying to see how our industry could lead in the fight against COVID-19. And I'm enormously proud of what this industry has accomplished as a result.
Absolutely. And I'm interested in following up on that, because I'm wondering how much of this, Kim, was a combination of like an enterprising CEO or plant manager saying, hey, we could probably either provide the materials or some cutting and sewing or whatever it was for surgical gowns or PPEs. How much of this was driven within NCTO as a coordinated effort, and how much of it might have been just ad hoc, like hospitals or other organizations reaching out to your members and saying, can you help us in this time of crisis?
Scott, that's a great question. And I would say things were happening concurrently as the supply chains were breaking down globally and there just wasn't enough supply. And COVID created some transportation challenges as a result as well. Our industry got calls. I personally got calls from the White House asking what our industry could do in relatively short order for face masks and for gowns. Our industry started receiving calls from nurses and doctors, even family members who are saying, how can you help? And so you saw this industry where a lot of our PPE production has gone offshore for decades, really challenge themselves in a short period of time to use innovation, ingenuity, and to build some partnerships, even among companies that sometimes are rivals, to creating the supply chains necessary what our nation needed at that time.
And so just in a short amount of time, I've read that folks were able to scale up pretty quickly and make a pretty sizable contribution to the response into producing mass quantities of surgical gowns and cloth masks and other types of medical grade equipment as well.
Absolutely. I mean, it is a testament to the industry. You know, many people think this industry has gone offshore and is an industry that used to exist in the United States. And we're here to tell you we're right here. We're happy to be put to work. And we made hundreds of millions of face masks and gowns and deployed those into the field, whether it was directly to hospital systems or it was to FEMA or to the Strategic National Stockpile. This industry stepped up to serve. And that's because our industry felt like we were uniquely positioned as our industry to help lead on this. The products that our medical workers needed were the things that our industry could make. And so my fear, Scott, is after all this is over, and we all hope that it comes to a conclusion very soon, that we don't forget about these supply chains, that we help ensure that we're actually making these products here in the United States of America. And if we don't heed the call, if we do not learn a lesson as a result of COVID-19, then we're at fault for that as a country and as a collective. This exposed fragility in our supply chain. But I will warn everybody that the fragility will exist if we don't help the supply chain grow in the United States. And we need some strong signals to make that happen.
You raise a good point, Kim, and I wanted to follow up on that because I know that you recently had the opportunity to share your point of view with the International Trade Commission, which has been asked by Congress to investigate COVID-19 related goods, import penetration, or other considerations. So what did you tell the commission about the kinds of public policy steps need to be taken to strengthen the domestic supply chain for PPEs that our textile manufacturers can contribute to?
I think I started my testimony warning the commission that we need to really look at this right now, because even looking at the global dominance of PPE production, since the onset of the pandemic, China's productivity of PPE has increased 5 times. they have started to solidify their global dominance in making critically needed items for our medical workers. So in order to really address this, you need to have a holistic approach to ensuring the industry stays onshore. That means we need strong domestic procurement laws. So when we are using taxpayer dollars, we're using those dollars to invest in communities and companies and workers who are making the products here. There's no need to source PPE from offshore and from Asia when we can have a supply chain here in the United States. Will you pay more for that PPE? Will the government pay more? Yes. But what will that mean for the tax base, and what will that mean for American jobs? I think that is indistinguishable in terms of cost. The other thing is our industry needs long-term contracts to help realize investment. I've got industry who are willing to invest hundreds of millions of dollars of making these products here, but they're not going to do it without a customer. And we think the federal government could be an important customer, not the only customer, to help in onshore the supply chain, but we need to have long-term contracts. Right now, the government's purchasing PPE maybe for a 90-day period, up to 120 days. And without a long-term contract, you're not going to see the industry really invest, because that's not a long-term demand signal. And because we think the government plays a really important role here to getting the policy tools right, including our trade enforcement mechanisms, that we ensure that if products are flooded into this market, we're taking corrective action. But we believe the combination of these things will help grow the industry in the United States and help make our pricing more cost competitive with other global supply chains, meaning our industry knows that we have another market to sell to. We'll have to sell to hospitals and distributors and others, but we need to get the pricing aligned. We need to get the equipment installed, and we need the automation necessary to help build the supply chain here in a cost competitive realm.
I'm glad you shared that, because I think that the important thing from a policy perspective is having both the demand, and so like the long-term contracts, along with the procurement policies that ensure that our tax dollars are being reinvested in our economy and are supporting our own mills and facilities and workers. I know that I worry from a broader manufacturing perspective that some policymakers are getting the message from some groups that maybe we don't want to be dependent on China, but we should certainly look at other kind of low-cost areas for this, and that it's unrealistic to reshore some of this. But it sounds like what you're telling me is that this isn't an industry that is just competing on wage price points now, is that you have a lot of advanced technology and a lot of specialization capabilities, but you do just lack the policy support to be able to have your companies make the longer term investments in their U.S. facilities.
Absolutely. I mean, we have the capabilities to doing this. There is the machinery that exists. We just need the incentive to move forward. If anything, this period of time illustrated is, wow, we weren't making these items in mass before COVID-19, and now we are, and we have proven we can. And we are making these products in our own backyard, which means there's a level of transparency with how the products are made, and there's a level of integrity on ensuring that those products meet the standards, the testing standards associated with compliance for our medical workers. And the concern here in COVID was we sourced a variety of products, often from Asian low-cost suppliers, namely from China, that didn't live up to its promise, you know, said they were N95 masks, and when you actually tested them, didn't work out. There's a level of transparency when you have these supply chains close to home and in our own backyard. There's a level of accountability that our industry has. And so I'm saying to you, Scott, that we can do it. Just put the right tools in place and we've got it. But, you know, when everyone says we can't, we shouldn't, there's no way, I don't think they've really challenged themselves to understand the opportunity that exists. And so that's what our industry is hoping to do, is to change that conversation.
Thank you for mentioning that. Are there an example or two of your members or facilities, companies that stepped up and were able to answer the call and pivot right away? Because I know that this was a gargantuan challenge.
We had several member companies step up. We had member company in Burlington, North Carolina, called Glen Raven. They make Sunbrella, the equipment that you have for outside, your patio furniture. And they stepped up to making medical gown fabric and face shields and retooled a lot of their operations through COVID-19. We had other companies like Milliken & Company, a long established company in Spartanburg, South Carolina, retooled their facilities to making medical gowns and other scrubs that are needed in medical settings. Our industry also, there was a huge need for reusable items. You know, in our healthcare setting, I think a lot of workers have become used to disposable. You know, I'm done with my shift, I can take off this gown and just throw it out. But because there was a crunch in the nonwovens market, which makes the disposable products, it's a huge opportunity for industry because my industry makes a lot of reusable products. So that means, yeah, you're going to pay a little bit more for gowns, but over the life of the product, it's actually far cheaper and much more sustainable. And so we're hoping that as a result of COVID-19, that more hospitals and other settings are going to use these kinds of products, especially the products that we can make here in the United States. So many member companies stepped up. I had member companies like Parkdale and US Cotton making medical testing kit swabs. There were only two testing kit swab producers in the world prior to COVID-19. Now there are three, and they are based in Cleveland, Ohio. And so I have companies like Gildan who are making face masks and gowns. This has been a huge all-industry effort and really heartened with the response of our great industry.
So, Kim, I know lately there's been some concern about the Uyghur population of ethnic Muslim Turkic people in Western China and their treatment by the Chinese government. Particularly, it looks like there's concentration camps and forced labor. And I know that the supply chain, obviously, for a lot of garments and textiles is very globalized. But I have to believe this is an enormous cause for concern, not only for, I think, American consumers, people who care about human rights, but also producers and having products that are both sustainable, that make sure that folks are paid a living wage, and certainly are staying away from things like forced and slave labor as well. What is the level of concern that you have about what's happening in the Uyghur area of Xinjiang and some of the reports that we've been hearing?
There's been significant analysis done on the atrocities of Uyghur labor in slave camps associated with producing products that we wear. I can't think of something that is just in this day and age that is just so gripping in terms of the fact that we have to have a holistic response to humanity and our fellow man. You know, 20% of the world's cotton production is actually sourced from the Xinjiang province. And it's been estimated that 1 in 5 garments that China sells globally involves some sort of forced labor production. This is a very pervasive problem associated with this, and it can't be tolerated. The reality is that there's a responsibility that we have as American citizens and for those who are sourcing products to ensure that they're not sourcing products that help perpetuate this terrible behavior. There needs to be a lot more transparency from the Chinese government as well as those who are sourcing products from this area or from China in general or across their supply chains. We cannot be perpetuating these human rights atrocities. And many organizations have been speaking out about this. I know the House recently passed a bill that the Senate will likely consider. We need to really get to the bottom of this, and we need the strongest enforcement tools to ensure that this does not happen. But this is a very complicated problem. There's a secret economy in China that needs to be exposed, and we need to fully understand, and we need to use all the tools at our disposal.
We've spent the past 2 episodes talking about the West's entanglement in China's use of forced labor for much of its supply chain, but especially its cotton production. Now, there's a big development. On December 2nd, the Trump administration banned imports containing cotton or cotton products made by the Xinjiang Production and Construction Corps after finding that the XPCC likely utilizes forced labor in its textile production. But what does it really mean? I caught up with Kim since we recorded our initial interview to learn more. So, Kim, there have been some significant developments since the last time we chatted. one, there was a U.S. election. We'll have a new president. And number two, the Trump administration has taken some action on China with respect to the forced labor situation. So I wanted to ask you first, how much of an impact will the U.S. ban on the cotton products coming from the Uyghur areas have on the global supply chain?
It all depends, Scott, on how well this will be enforced by the outgoing Trump administration and the incoming Biden administration. We were pleased to see that this administration wanted to get aggressive on the human rights abuses by addressing an import ban on cotton and cotton products. Most recently, they had a decision around the Xinjiang Production Construction Corporation, where essentially 30% of Xinjiang cotton is made in this paramilitary organization that has been tied to forced labor practices. But like anything, in terms of global production chains, it's very difficult to track the cotton. Where does that cotton go? And it's also difficult to track the supply chain. So for our industry, and for our free trade agreement partners who have been hurt by the trade practices and the human rights abuses that are occurring in Xinjiang, it is critical that there are strong enforcement mechanisms in place to ensure that these products aren't finding a backdoor to the U.S. market.
So one thing that I imagine is a concern as well is cotton continuity. And since we'll have a new administration in 2021, how do you and your member companies hope to see the Biden administration approach this specific issue with respect to XPCC cotton, but also more broadly with respect to forced labor in China's textile manufacturing supply chain?
We believe it's critical that the Biden administration continues a significant and aggressive approach on the atrocities that are happening in Xinjiang. I think first and foremost, they need to do a systematic review around some of these import bans to see if they are in fact accomplishing what we're hoping they accomplish. Second, we need to ensure that brands and retailers, these multinational corporations who are globally sourcing, understand their supply chains and verify those supplies. We should not be continuing to feed this practice. We need to get even more aggressive and work as part of an international coalition. And that is something President-elect Biden has talked about and is something that we're expecting as an industry moving forward.
Thanks, Kim. And one last question on the Biden administration, in addition to this ban on products made with forced labor, and understanding that the pandemic's unfortunately going to be with us for at least months to come, hopefully not any longer than that, and precipitating the need for PPE. What steps do you hope the Biden administration will take to strengthen our domestic capacity for PPE and more broadly?
The Biden administration has made a key part of their platform strengthening domestic supply chains for PPE and other products. We'd like to see in the first few months of the Biden administration for them to actually develop an executive order and to work with Congress on a longer term solution on solidifying these supply chains. There's many things they can do. One is, let's use taxpayer dollars wisely. U.S. government has become a major purchaser of PPE. But many of us have read the headlines. A lot of this is being imported from China. When we have domestic manufacturers in our own backyard with no orders and ability, however, to make this PPE, we shouldn't be doing that. There's no reason we should see any headlines these days that people are struggling to get PPE when we have domestic suppliers here. So we'd like to see the Biden administration and want to work with the Biden administration on advancing procurement strategies. We also want to see a significant investment in our manufacturing sector. If you are planning on buying equipment, if you're hiring workers, we want to see the U.S. government support those activities. Our manufacturing sector is key, not just for our particular industry, but across the nation. And it's critical that we get these policies right on day one.
And I imagine that this is an issue where you can find some bipartisan agreement to carry over. And I imagine you've thought that through as well.
Absolutely. And there's been huge support on the Hill, both from Republicans and Democrats, around strengthening our procurement laws, on strengthening our manufacturing sector. President-elect Biden wrote a key part of his platform was to bring the parties together and find consensus. This is one area that he can strike many wins early on and work with his Republican counterparts on, and we want to be part of those conversations.
Kim Glass, President and CEO of the National Council of Textile Organizations, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks so much, Scott.
That will do it for the Manufacturing Report this week. To learn more about the National Council of Textile Organizations and its member companies, you can visit ncto.org. As always, I want to thank AAM staff and Kat Adams in particular for their work to make this episode possible, and I also want to thank you, the listeners, for engaging with us and for giving us some great episode ideas. Please be sure to subscribe to the Manufacturing Report on Spotify or wherever you find your podcasts, and let us know what you think by leaving a review and a rating. You can find us online at AmericanManufacturing.org. You can follow us on Facebook or Instagram, and you can connect with us on Twitter at KeepItMadeInUSA. I'm Scott Paul, and until next time, together, we can keep it made in America.